Hello there, everybody, and welcome to the latest Rainmaker Platform Q&A. This is part of our Rainmaker Platform Site Building Roadmap series. I am Jared Morris. I'll be hosting today. Let me introduce my co-host, Chris Garrett. Mr. Garrett, how's it going?
Hello, everybody. I hope you can hear us.
So thank you again to everybody who sent questions in ahead of time. We always love getting the questions ahead of time, because it allows us to really prepare answers, and we can put together screenshots and go out and ask people in our company who would know the answers better than we would. And so, just as you'll see as we go through this Q&A, you get better answers that way. So we'll be happy if there's time at the end. We're going to go for about an hour. We'll be happy if there's time at the end to answer some additional questions, but we will be answering all of the questions that were submitted ahead of time first, and that is how all of these Q&As will go. So just a heads up for the future. And again, there will be one of these Q&As every other week with a webinar in between as we continue on this Rainmaker site building roadmap and help you build a great digital commerce website with the Rainmaker platform, because that's our goal. All righty, Chris, you ready to rock and roll through here and start answering some
Yes, but
questions?
Heinrich says Heinrich's got 36 questions, so we better get through these.
36, okay. Well, there we go. All righty. Well, this Q&A is the Q&A kind of attached to our first webinar in the Rainmaker Site Building Roadmap series, and that webinar was about basic Rainmaker site settings. And so we opened up this Q&A to answer any questions that you have on basic Rainmaker site settings. You gave us a lot of really good questions, and so we look forward to answering those for you today, and we will hop right in and start answering them right now. So question one is from Bob. And Bob says that we mentioned Google Analytics in last week's webinar, and in the comments, someone posted a brief link to a cure for Google Analytics ghost spam. Bob wants to know, how significant are both ghost spam and crawler spam, and what are the consequences to a typical Rainmaker website of not doing whatever is necessary to get rid of them? Can we give any best practices advice on which of these methods, or anything else that we know that is better, is the best way for non or partially technical website builders to give Google Analytics spam the amount of attention it needs without taking away too much time from all of the other critical aspects of creating and maintaining a successful Rainmaker site? This is a great question, Bob, and fortunately, we have the perfect person in our company to answer that question, and that is Lauren Thompson, who is our data analyst, who has done a lot of work with Google Analytics. I knew she would have, or I thought she would have a great answer to this, and she absolutely did. And so I actually sent her your question via email. And I am straight up just pasting what she put here, because she explains it so much better than I could. So she started out by saying, it's not worth the stress. Website analytics data is not exact, and at some point, it's just not worth the effort or money to remove every single little spam hit. If you do really care about it, then Analytics Edge and Optimize Smart do have some good ideas about removing spam. I would also recommend Lunametrics, and there are lots more. But it's not a service you should feel the need to pay for. That's going too far. Lauren continued by saying, the main cause of Google Analytics spam is bots that ping Google Analytics account numbers with fake information through the Google Analytics API, or measurement protocol. That's ghost spam. And in her experience, it comprises the bulk of the spam most websites get, which is why people tend to say it is the most effective way to remove spam, or the cure, as you mentioned it in your original question. Crawler spam, also known as referral spam, is crawler bots, much like the crawlers that search engines use, that do actually visit your site, but don't represent real people. And she's found Google Analytics' built-in option to exclude bot traffic does a great job of excluding this traffic. So if you turn on Google Analytics bot traffic filtering and use a hostname filter, you are likely to remove most, if not all, of the spam traffic on your site. And she sent over a couple of useful screenshots here for where you actually do this in Google Analytics. Now, we can't dive too deeply into how to do this with Google Analytics, but these screenshots will help put you on the right track, because the settings can be found under admin in your Google Analytics account, which is, they've changed it, it's now a gear icon in the lower left-hand corner. And so what this screenshot is showing you is how you can do the bot filtering. So this will allow you to exclude all hits from known bots and spiders. And then this screenshot shows you how to do the hostname filter that Lauren mentioned. So both of those actions will help you in your quest to manage this spam. Lauren also notes that before you make any changes to your account settings, be sure to set up a view without any filters, a quote-unquote raw view, because this will track all traffic to your site just in case you accidentally exclude something that you actually want to keep. And finally, you know, you asked about the implications of spam. So, you know, if you don't do this, here are the implications of not removing spam. Number one, your site session numbers will be artificially inflated and won't represent real people on your site, which is important if you are using session or user data to calculate conversion rates, because bots obviously don't convert. And number two, any behavior metrics that you track on your site, such as time on page, pages per session, and of course conversion rates, will be skewed by the bots, because bots don't behave like humans do online. That being said, it's okay if your analytics data has a very small amount of spam mixed in. At a certain point, it's not worth the trouble to track it all down and keep up with it. So there's no hard rule for how much spam is quote-unquote okay in your Google Analytics account. But, you know, according to Lauren and her wisdom on this, she would say that if you've already taken basic steps to remove it and the remaining spam is less than 5% of your overall traffic, she wouldn't worry about it beyond that. So if you like that answer and found it helpful, shoot her a tweet, at Lauren with a Y. I'm sure she would appreciate knowing that her answer was appreciated, because she put a lot of time into it, and I really appreciate her doing that. Chris, anything else that you would add to Lauren's answer here?
Yeah, definitely say thank you to Lauren. I'm sure she'd welcome any follow-up questions. I will say my Maker Hacks site, it's only a year old now, and it was being taken over by this spam. My referring sites list was basically all spam for, you know, like 8 out of 10 the referrers were spam. And so I did this, and it's cured it for me. So especially with a new site or a site with low traffic, you might find that the spam dominates. So if you take these small actions, it probably clears up the majority of it to make it at least usable. And like she says, you need to be basing your decision making on real data. So you don't want your conversion rates or your referrers to be skewed. So if you have a goal set up, say your goal is email subscriptions or purchases, and you're getting 100 spam visitors for every real visitor you get, that's really going to skew your figures, because you're going to not have the correct click-through rates, conversion rates, opt-in rates, right? So for a new site or a site where, say, a couple of hundred spam visitors makes a big difference, then you do want to do this, and it's pretty easy. So where in the screenshots she had Ridewell, you would put your own website URL in there instead. And that's as easy as it gets. So she's got weridewell.com. You would put example.com. You would put your website.com.
Yep. Excellent. All right. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Lauren. So let's move on to question number two. This question comes to us from Fred, and Fred says, on setting up HTTPS, isn't it preferred by Google these days? Also, he heard that it may cause issues when embedding content, say from YouTube or Vimeo or SoundCloud, that is not an HTTPS link. So what are appropriate practices when setting HTTPS as default for the entire site? How about setting internal links? Should we use HTTPS, or should we skip the HTTP or HTTPS and just use the slug? So let me handle this from the technical side of things first. Because your first step, Fred, and this really kind of gets into to HTTPS best practices if you've decided this is what you want to do. So the first step is going to be to check your Rainmaker HTTPS settings, all right, and make sure that you have everything set up properly. So if you go into your general settings, and again, you know, the settings gear icon, hit general, you will see the HTTPS section right here. Now, the screenshot that I'm showing you this from is a preview site, so you actually can't even add HTTPS to a preview site, but you would have a button here for configure or enable HTTPS if you hadn't done it yet and your site was live. And so obviously if you're going to use HTTPS, you want to enable it, and it's a very, very simple process that you go through to do this, all handled by Rainmaker. Once it is set up, then you want to check and make sure that you have the right selection made. So your HTTPS is set up. You can enable HTTPS only on the checkout page, or you actually have the option to put it on the entire site. So you can make that choice. So, you know, for instance, on one of my sites, assemblycall.com, which I'm showing here, I have it just on the checkout page, but there are some reasons why you might want to do it on the entire site as well. So you can make that choice right there. The next step, in terms of HTTPS best practices is to check your website at winopadlock.com. And hat tip to Brian Hayes for letting me know about this site earlier today. But what you can do here is you can put in a URL, and it will tell you maybe what your site is missing from an HTTPS perspective. So I pasted in my preview URL, and no surprise, it says that this URL domain is invalid. It's not secure, and of course it's not, because it doesn't even have HTTPS enabled. So no surprise there. For the other site that I mentioned, assemblycall.com, where I have it only on the checkout site, it says that the certificate was found, it's valid, but it is throwing an error on the homepage. And again, that's to be expected, because I've only got it on the checkout page, not on the entire site. So you can use this site right here to uncover whether you have any issues that you need to address, and I would highly recommend that you do so. And then finally, you want to check your URLs, because if you think, you know, that a page should be showing you the little padlock and be coming up as secure, but it's not, you might have an erroneous URL. Because if your entire site is HTTPS, then all of the URLs on that site need to be HTTPS, or else it won't come back as secure. If your checkout page is HTTPS, then all the URLs on that page only. If only your checkout page is HTTPS, then only the URLs on that page, and this includes images, need to be HTTPS. Now, that might seem to bring up some complications if you have, you know, if you want to do this on your entire site and you have all these URLs that are, you know, coded as HTTP, what do you do if you want HTTPS? Well, a best practice, especially if you want to kind of future-proof your site, thinking that you may want to go to full HTTPS later, is to use protocol relative URLs, right? So what that means is, instead of http://url.com, just use //url.com. And let me show you a real quick example of how you would actually do this inside a piece of content. So you have url.com, and you want this to create a clickable link. Okay, so you're in your visual editor, you type url.com. This is text, but it's not yet clickable. So next, you highlight it and you click the link button, and that will bring up this insert edit link little form right here. And so you just, instead of typing in the whole HTTP thing like you might normally do, just do /, url.com. This will create the protocol relative URL. Right? And so if you look at the syntax of the URL in the text editor, how it's actually coded, now you've got this proper structure right here. And what this will do, just having the slashes but not defining the HTTP or the HTTPS, it means that this link will take on the characteristic of the page. So if your page is HTTPS, then this link will be HTTPS, and it won't throw an error because you have it hard-coded as HTTP. Now, hopefully that makes sense. I know it can get a little bit confusing. But it will appear as a normal clickable link to anybody who's looking. No one will know the difference, but it won't negatively affect the HTTPS security of the page or site, because again, when it's protocol relative, it will pick up the correct link structure of that particular page. Chris, anything else to add on this? And anything, getting back to Fred's first question about HTTPS now being preferred by Google?
Yeah, so my site that I mentioned earlier is a year old, and it's getting great search traffic, and it does not have HTTPS on. And the reason I've resisted it is because of what you've just been talking about, Jared, where you have to go through and fix all your embedded images and all your embedded media to have HTTPS links or relative links. So I've just been lazy. But Google still likes my site and is still sending me a lot of search traffic. One of my biggest referrers is Google. So Facebook and Google dominate my referrers. It's not affecting it negatively. That's not to say it won't do in future. So I will be moving to HTTPS. I just have to find the time. And I'll probably, as Jared mentioned, I'll probably start with my checkout and my login pages. But the other part of the equation is web browsers. And so the web browsers, Chrome especially, are starting to highlight when a site is quote unquote insecure. So just because it doesn't have HTTPS doesn't mean that it's a scary site and you're going to catch something from it. But the implication for many people would be, oh, it's insecure, that means I should avoid it. So you might start getting some pushback in future if you don't move to HTTPS, which is why it's included. You know, it's like, it's straightforward to set up, but then you might find you've got some embedded media or images in your pages that are stopping it to be insecure. So,
yeah, and the question included, you know, Vimeo links and YouTube links and that kind of thing. Well, same thing. You can actually go into the embed code, and where there's a URL, again, just use the protocol relative URL, you know, remove the HTTP, and then it will pick up what your page is. Hey, Chris, let me ask you a question. Because, you know, let's say that I wanted to do this on assembly call for my entire site, and I've got, you know, 5-6 years worth of content out there. You know, if I said, okay, I want all of my URLs now to be HTTPS, is there some kind of like search and replace that I can do or that someone can do that would be able to change all those URLs at once, or is that a manual job?
It may be something you can do through the services team. I'm looking to Amelia and Ryan to ping us on the chat box. It's not something you can just search and replace within Rainmaker, because it basically means going through every piece of content in your database and doing a search and replace. And URLs are something you don't really want to break. So it might be something that you'd have to go through the services team. Brian says our hosting team can help with search and replace. So there you go.
Okay, very cool.
Contact support and they'll direct you to the right place.
Yep. Absolutely, and again, hat tip to Brian, who's there helping us out answer questions, because he helped me put these slides together. So thank you for that, Brian. Question number 3, this is from Carol. So Carol says that right now our profile settings are in my business partner's name, but most everything we do is a joint effort, so we want to attribute blog posts to both of us and use a joint bio. How can we do both? Also, how do I set up a bio for a guest author? Great question, Carol. I will show you exactly how to do that, because we have this exact same case really all the time on all of our different sites here at Rainmaker Digital. So the example that I am showing you, this is from Rainmaker.fm, all right, our podcast network. And so, you know, podcast episode, post, page, it's all kind of the same when it comes to this and maybe assigning a piece of content to a joint bio, but you also want your own bio. So if you look here, I did a quick search just for my name, Jared, since it's, you know, got the odd spelling. The only thing that came up were my own profiles here. So you see I've got my main profile, right? And this is the one that I would use for any podcast episodes or blog posts that are only by me. But I have a co-host on the Showrunner podcast, and that is John Naster. And so we created a special bio just for this show, Showrunner, and it has both of us, Jared Morris and John Naster. And I think the way that we set that up is the first name is Jared Morris and the last name is John Naster, and then where you can define your display name when you're editing your profile, we just made sure that it said Jared Morris and John Naster, because that is what will come up on the site. And then you want to make sure that this user profile has at least the author access settings or author, just that it is an author, because that is what you will need for it to come up among your choices to assign a piece of content to it. All right, so there's nothing fancy or about this. You basically just want to go hit Add New and create a new bio for this shared account that you're going to have. And then inside the edit section, I'll show you this in a minute, that is where you actually go edit your bio, and you would edit it exactly like you would edit any profile, as we explained in our last webinar. Then once you want to choose this, again, when you're here inside editing a post or a page or a podcast, there's a little widget for author, and this is where you choose the correct user for a given piece of content. All right, so there's a little drop down. Just hit that drop down. You'll see that I could have chosen my own, you know, my individual profile for this, or I can choose my shared profile for this. So just make sure that you choose the right profile. And again, all of these people need to have the author access level so that you can choose them for this. And then you can also use the quick edit to change the author for a piece of content. And Amelia, hat tip to Amelia, she reminded me of this earlier today. So you can, if you go to, you know, the main kind of post index page or podcast episodes or whatever it is, any content type, click on quick edit. And then when you click on quick edit, it'll bring up a number of kind of meta options here that you can change really quickly. So you can edit the author for it, you could change the date, you could change the slug, change the categories, a bunch of different things that you can change here real quick without actually having to leave this page. It's all on that same page, so you don't have to load it. It's just much more convenient for you. And so for the author specifically, you would just use the drop-down menu to do that. And you can also make bulk edits to your content from this very same page. I didn't even realize this earlier today. But this was a really cool find. And again, hat tip to Amelia for this. But if you basically check the items that you want to edit and then just choose edit from the bulk actions drop-down menu, this will then open up this little menu right here. And so all of the items that you chose are right here. And if you chose one on accident, you can just click the X to remove it so it won't be included in these bulk edits anymore. And let's say that you want to change the author. Well, just edit the author using the author drop-down box, exactly as you would do if you were editing an individual piece. And you can change the other options similarly. So add a category to it, add a tag to all these pages, whatever it is that you're changing, it will be applied to all of these posts. And then once you're done, click update if you want to save the changes, or you can cancel it to leave the items unchanged. And it is that simple. And again, if you want to go in and create a new profile for this joint bio or for a guest author, it's exactly the same. You're basically just treating your guest author like you would, you know, any other member. You just, of course, want to make sure that you don't give them admin or editor access, make them an author, but you would just use this button, add new, and then go through and edit that profile exactly as we explained before. And when you do want to edit your member profile, you just click edit underneath the profile name, and that will take you to the place where you can add the bio, you know, click the checkbox for adding the author box. All of those different options are right there. So pretty simple, Carol. That's certainly the way that I would do it. Anything to add to that, Mr. Garrett?
No, that's good. The only thing that you might find, depending on the theme or depending on how the bios and the way it's displayed works, is you might want to add a gravatar for that combined user. But yeah, that's a quick way of doing it.
Yep. Excellent. Good question, Carol. We move on now to Nicholas's question. So Nicholas says, if the domain is currently hosted by GoDaddy with almost no content and will be transferred to Rainmaker, should the domain transfer happen before the site is ready to go live in order to have working email addresses through the domain? So just kind of a note for, you know, for all of these types of questions for the future on these webinars, you know, anything that deals with domain and email and transferring and migrations and all of that, it's going to be somewhat difficult for us to answer beyond just giving you general answers on these Q&As, because there can be so many kind of specific elements to this based on your case. And so for a lot of these, we will refer you to support, because that's where you can actually get the best answer. With that being said, there is a lot of excellent kind of general content to help you with this process in the knowledge base. And so what I want to do, Nicholas, is I want to point you to some content in the knowledge base that would just kind of take us too long to explain here in a Q&A format, and I think would actually be much more efficient for you to be able to go read and then pick out the parts that are relevant to you and your situation. So if you scroll over help and just simply search for domain in the help search bar, that will bring you to this page right here. And so I would choose the tutorial named How Do I Launch My Site to a Live Domain Name. It was when I searched for domain, it was the first one that came up. And so when you go into that, and this is a screenshot from that page, it walks you through all of these steps to help make sure that the process of going live on the domain that you have chosen, along with the email transition, that all of that goes smoothly. And so number 4 right here actually addresses exactly how to plan for the email transition and tells you exactly what you would need to do. And there are further steps down that page. So it shows you, because what will happen is, you know, when you're going live, you will actually, you know, choose your email host, and there's a series of steps that you go through. Well, this page in the knowledge base prepares you for that, shows you exactly what you need to do. And so that is what I would do. As you get ready to enter that process, I would go through the knowledge base, because all those steps are right there in a step-by-step process. And if you do have questions that don't get answered by the knowledge base or that come up during the process, then I would definitely ask support, because they will be in the best position to answer those questions for you.
Yeah, if in doubt, I would ask support anyway, because one of the things that we've found in the past is people have rushed through the process and then support can't email you because your email's bouncing. So it's good to set up a support ticket and maybe have support know what your alternate email account is. So if they can't email you, they can email you on another account.
That's a great tip. That is a great tip, yes. Because, yeah, you don't want to be send, you know, not have an email and be able to be contacted. So Excellent tip, Chris. Okay, now here is one of Heinrich's 36 questions. So Heinrich says, so that I understand it, since I have been out of the loop, so to speak, the name for my new site in general settings will become my domain name and then my URL, or are these separate entities from the site name? And he also asks, can the domain name be something like HDS Fine Art? Can I change it later if I so desire after launching the site? So this is a really good question, Heinrich, and this one we can clear up here in the Q&A just to make sure that everybody is clear on this. So what I'm showing you here is a screenshot from the settings page for Digital Commerce Institute. All right. So the domain for Digital Commerce Institute, the text that you type into your address bar to go to the website, that is the domain name. All right. It is the URL for the website, and for Digital Commerce Institute, that is digitalcommerce.com. Now, it's very important to note that you must register your domain from a third-party provider, not from Rainmaker. We don't sell or host domain names, right? We host your site, but you have to have a domain name from a provider of domains, right? And you can change this later, but it's a bit of an involved process because you actually have to migrate your entire site to the new domain. Now, that is different from the site name. So again, the site name is Digital Commerce Institute, obviously different from digitalcommerce.com. Now, the site name could be the same as your domain name. Like, for example, the URL for Rainmaker.fm is Rainmaker.fm, and so the site name and the domain are the same. But in most cases, the name of your site will be different from the domain name. All right, and you can change the site name anytime you want to, and it's as easy as coming in here and changing the name in your general settings. And that's not going to have some big impact. It will impact the name of your site in search engine results, and it can impact what's displayed in your header depending on your theme choice, but it is very simple to come in here and change. So domain name and site name are different. And so, and actually, Heinrich, I would there's a couple of articles in the knowledge base that I think would help you too. And so I will offer kind of the same recommendation here, which is go into help and just search for domain. And there are a couple of articles that I think would be good for you. One is the same one that I just mentioned, how do I launch my site to a live domain name, and then also domain registrar help. Because if you don't have a domain yet or you need to get a different domain, this article right here lists a number of domain registrars that you can use. Has their website, has their support numbers right there, so you can get right on the process of getting a new domain if you need one. So those will help you out. Chris, anything to add?
Yeah, while support can change the domain for you if you decide that you like a new domain better than the old one, it is an involved process, and you do have to go through support because they have to change a lot of things within the database as well as just change the domain name details. One reason I would caution changing is because if you've got any Google authority on your old domain and you start from a brand new one, then you lose all that trust because Google says, hey, I don't know this domain, it's a new domain to me, so I'm going to be cautious about sending traffic to it until I'm sure that it's okay. So you would get a dip in your traffic and you would get a dip in your search results. It does recover, especially if the old domain is redirected to the new one, so you don't get page not found errors. But it's worth going through support, and it can guide you through that process so that you can get the smoothest transition possible.
Yeah, and let me go back to Heinrich's question real quick, because he said, can the domain be something like HDS Fine Art? So again, your domain would not be HDS Fine Art. It might be HDSFineArt.com. You know, if you had that domain, you could do that. But HDS Fine Art, as you have it typed there, that would be your site name. So, and it is, it's nice if you can get a domain that is very closely associated with your site name. That certainly helps. But in most cases, they probably won't be able to be exactly the same. So that's how you want to approach that, Heinrich. Good luck with that. Let's go on now to Fred. And Fred's question is, don't recall if you have a session planned on results and metrics or not, but that would be great to understand and interpret the dashboard analytics reports, plus hints and tips using the results reports and from within Google Analytics. As Fred says, it's a confusing and overwhelming amount of data and would really like to know what is useful to judge and improve engagement with the site's content and to improve conversion. So we will have sessions in the future that will dive into results a little bit more. And we will actually talk about results you know, in places where it's relevant. So, for instance, when we do the podcast sessions, we'll talk about the podcast reports in there. And so we will get into that as we move forward in this Rainmaker site building roadmap. But I do want to point out one area that I think is relevant to this discussion, and that is the dashboard widgets that you can add right there from within your Rainmaker dashboard, because they give you really useful results snapshots, and you can arrange them to suit your needs so that as soon as you log into your Rainmaker site, you can get a nice little snapshot of whatever is important for you to be measuring. So if you have a blog and site traffic is the biggest thing for you, you know, you can have your Google Analytics summary right here and kind of get a snapshot of how traffic looks. And so, for example, for the site that's pictured here, we have notable spikes on particular days where we have a live event. And so it makes perfect sense to me when I look at this snapshot that traffic would kind of have these spikes and then dips, and spikes and then dips in between live events. So I can get a nice look there, and I can say, okay, well, you know, that's kind of interesting. We had this really big spike here. I wonder why that is. Or if I saw, you know, let's say, you know, two straight weeks where all the dots were down here and I'm not getting the spikes, I would wonder, all right, so what's going on in the days when we have our live event? So being able to have that quick visual that you just see as soon as you log in can highlight maybe some immediate issues that you would want to kind of dig into further. And then with the Google Analytics summary then, and I'll show you all the data that actually comes in the Google Analytics summary widget, because there's a lot of it. But you can see, you know, your visits, your page views, pages per visit, the bounce rate, the average time on site, the percent of new visits. So you can kind of track, you know, how those change over time. And as you continue to log in and look at this, you'll start to get an idea for, you know, what is a reasonable number of visits, you know, what is your pages per visit normally? Is it usually up in the twos and now it dropped to the ones? I wonder why that might be. You know, are people bouncing too often? Bounce rate is when people just come to one page and then leave. They don't go to another page on your site. And so these are all numbers that are really utterly meaningless outside of context, because, you know, a pages per visit of 1.9 could be really good for a certain type of site and could be awful for another type of site. For this site, it's actually okay. You know, like, I'm fine with that number. For the bounce rate, I'm okay with that because we have a live event where a lot of times we send people to one page and there's really no call to action other than that. We want them to watch that event. And so a lot of people bounce after that. And so we know our bounce rate, you know, is going to be up a little higher than maybe it would if our site content wasn't oriented that way. And so it's really important, you know, to kind of look at these numbers over time. And when you do go into the actual Google Analytics reports in Rainmaker, it'll show you, okay, this is up or down from the previous month. So it doesn't show you that here in the dashboard widget, but you can see that as you go through. And we'll dive into that even further in a future webinar. Same thing with, you know, your Rainmail subscribers. If you're using Rainmail, you can see how your subscribers grow. So I know that just in the last week, we've added 14 subscriptions, which is good. You know, I like to track and see how that goes, and that's pretty good. I can also look at it by month and by year to get the bigger trends. And this show obviously has a podcast, and so I like to be able to have a snapshot to see, because on the day when a podcast comes out, I know that the download numbers should be up and that they go down by about this much the day after. So this all looks good. And again, that's the thing with numbers, is it's all about context and it's about trends. And so just being able to see these every time that you log in really helps you to get comfortable with where your site normally is and to make sure that you're growing as you want to be growing. Now, I'll show you just a little bit more here with the Google Analytics summary. So all of this will show in your widget. And obviously, this is a lot of information. So you can just click this little arrow button to close it if you don't want the whole thing to show up on the dashboard. So it's not like it's, you know, going to clutter up your page by showing you all of this if you don't want it to be there. It's really easy to collapse that menu. And so we explain the base stats. Well, you can also see some extended stats in terms of top posts. And I love to be able to see this because I like to be able to see, you know, which pages are doing well and then how recent pages are doing. Like all of these, which have the date on them, you know, it kind of gives me a snapshot of which ones did better maybe than others did and which pages are getting the most traffic. I can also see searches. So, for example, like I can tell right from here, this is for the assembly call, I can tell that brand searches are doing pretty well. Right, when people search for assembly call, you know, they're obviously getting our site because that's our top referring traffic. What is a little bit concerning to me is that our topic, which is, you know, Indiana basketball, Indiana Hoosiers basketball, that's not necessarily driving traffic. And so just looking at this, I know, okay, maybe there's some search engine optimization work I can do on this site because we're not driving enough traffic from our top keywords. So that might be an area where we can drive more traffic in the future. And so I can get that by looking at those keywords, seeing what is driving traffic and what isn't. And then I can also see my top referrers. So it's not like I'm not getting traffic from Google, because obviously it's the top referrer, but the search terms suggest to me that there's a lot more that we could be doing with Google. Direct traffic, this makes total sense because we do so much with email, and people who come to your site via email, clicking on a link, they will be picked up here in direct traffic. We do a lot on Twitter. This link from bracketmatrix.com, it's nice to see that that's driving so much traffic, and so you can see, you know, which referrers are really doing well for you. So again, it provides you with a snapshot, and it basically allows you to say, hey, something looks off here, and then you would probably want to dig in more. And that may mean, you know, going into the results in Google Analytics in Rainmaker, which will show you a lot. It won't show you everything, so there are some things you may still want to log into your Google Analytics account for, but you can certainly get snapshots and get summary data and have the ability to do really 80 to 85%, I would say, of the analytics analysis that you want to do. You can do all from your dashboard, which makes it really, really convenient and gives you the peace of mind that you're not going to miss some major trend just by being in your dashboard, and that is obviously a nice thing to give you some peace of mind. Chris, anything to add here for the analytics?
Yeah, so don't get overwhelmed is the big one. But as Jared says, these dashboard widgets give you a really good snapshot. And if you're competing against yourself, then it's not going to be as bad as thinking, oh, what's a good amount of traffic and what's a good bounce rate? Just try and improve your own and base it on your own context. And the things that Jared's got on screen, I think, are really important, like knowing what the top searches are, knowing who's referring the most traffic to you, and what the top posts are, and your traffic trend. That's all really important to know, and you can just dip into that every day or every other day, and it's not going to be a massive effort. When we come back to things like traffic, and as Jared says, podcasting and blogging, we'll look at more specific things, because then you're actually looking at, you're on a mission, right? You've got an intention that you want to achieve a certain thing, so you need to see if you're actually achieving the things that you want to achieve and if what you're doing is working. So we'll dive into specific metrics and KPIs and statistics when we get to the particular sessions, because that's going to have all the context that you need.
By the way, this is my favorite search term. I don't know if someone was typing on their phone or what was going on with this one, but hey, we'll take it. At least it drew traffic. They got what they were looking for. So
I'm really proud with my nerdy site that people are searching for 3D printer brands and finding my website. So it means that hopefully some manufacturer is going to start sending me review items instead of me having to spend lots of money and hide it from my wife.
That would be wonderful.
Well, she's going to be editing this, so it's out there now. The cat's out of the bag.
It is. Alrighty, let's go on now to Nicholas's second question. So Nicholas actually asked a question about the LMS, which obviously isn't technically a basic Rainmaker setting, but the way to answer his question is a setting. And so we wanted to answer that here real quick in this session. So Nicholas asks, can the modules and lessons in the LMS sidebar be made to collapse so that lessons only drop down when a module is clicked on? And the answer is yes, and it's very, very simple. So let me show you an example. This is from assemblycall.com, and so I have this 50 Greatest Hoosiers of All Time. It's basically a content series, but it's set up like an LMS. And so if you look right here, all of these are different modules. So this is the course. These are the modules right here. And as you can see, they're all collapsed by default, so you can't actually see the lessons yet. All right, they're hidden until you click on them. Once you click, like I just clicked here on starting five, now all of the lessons came up. And so if I were to click on one of these, it would bring me to the individual lesson page then that correlates with this. And if I were to click on the starting five again, then it would collapse and it would go back to looking like it did before. So very, very easy, and it really gives your LMS sidebar a really nice, clean look for the user. Now, here's the way that you actually do that. Again, it's really, really simple. So what you want to do is you want to navigate to design and then content areas. So if you're using the navigation bar here in the dashboard, just click on the design icon and then click on content areas. And then all you need to do is go locate your LMS sidebar. Okay? And so for this one, it was Top 50 Hoosiers. That's the sidebar. I click on it to open it up, and there is a setting for collapsible modules. You want to click the check mark on collapsible modules, hit save, and that is all you have to do, and now your modules become collapsible. And so your user clicks on them to open them up and see the lessons. If they click on it again, it closes it. It is that simple, Nicholas. Anything else, Chris?
Yeah, so you need to be using the LMS navigation widget. So if you've not started your course, you're not going to have a course sidebar. So you need to set up your sidebar, drag that LMS sidebar to it, and in your course, your modules, and your lessons, you need to specify that you want to use that sidebar. But it's all in the knowledge base. This just gives you a quick overview of what you need to do.
Yep, and we obviously will be doing sessions in the future on the LMS going over these items in detail, but that is the setting, the particular setting that you would need for that to work. All right, Carol has another question, and so Carol says, the form on the contact page is already there on the Rainmaker Pro template. If I add the short code for the form like you show in the video, the form shows up twice. Where is the default form indicated on the contact page layout if I wanted to delete or change it? So Carol is correct, and actually what I showed you in that first webinar was probably a little bit incomplete, and if you followed those exact instructions, you probably would have two forms, because there was one important piece of information that I left out about the default form. And so let's go over that right now. And where you want to go to check this, if you are going to be using the default form on your contact page, is navigate to Content and then Forms. All right. And when you do that, then if you're just starting a new site, you'll only have one form. It'll be the default contact form. Click Edit to edit that form. And then there is a setting for add the form to this page. And the default form is set to automatically appear on the contact page. Now, you can leave this if you want to. Then you want to remove the short code from the contact page, or not add the short code in the first place. Okay? Or if you do want to use the short code, then choose none here, as opposed to contact being chosen so that it automatically adds the form to the contact page. Choose none, and then it won't automatically add the form. You will just have to add the short code. And again, when we talk about the short code on the contact page, that would be this short code right here. Again, remove this if you keep the option to add the form to the contact page, or keep it if you choose to remove that option, whichever one you want. But if you have the short code there and you're dictating it to automatically add the form to the contact page, then it will show up twice.
And there's a third way as well. If you edit the page, there's actually a little drop down quite far down the page editing screen. All the way down where you set the featured image, there's a append a form drop down where you can choose a form there as well. So there's three ways of getting the form into your page.
Very nice.
By default, it's using that form edit that add form to this page and contact is chosen.
Yeah. And the nice thing about that is just make sure that, you know, when you start your site, if you happen to forget about your contact page, you've got the form on there so people can use it, which is nice to have. But yeah, there's three different ways to do that. You can choose whichever one works best for your site and your workflow. Okay, moving on. Fred, this is, you know, almost more of a suggestion than it was a question, but he says, when talking about the bio in the author box, it made him think that Copyblogger has a bunch of articles on how to create a great bio, and there are articles on a bunch of the topics you're talking about. How about linking to the best or most practical articles for each topic you were covering, plus linking directly to the Rainmaker help pages, or point to them or how to find them with search? Just an idea. And I love this idea, Fred. And so I wanted to bring it here, even though it's not necessarily a question to answer, because we certainly will do that. And that's one of the reasons why I've been, you know, showing you the step-by-step process for looking stuff up in the knowledge base and the exact article that you will want to click on. But we will also start adding that to the individual lesson pages for the webinars and for the Q&As. So, you know, we'll probably mention some of those resources, whether it's a Copyblogger article or whether it's a knowledge base article, on the session itself. But we will, even if we don't mention them, we will put them onto the lesson, the replay pages, as references. So certainly make sure that you go there. Even if you've been to the live event, you know, when we send out the notification that the replay is ready, go there, because there are likely to be some additional resources that may help you out, in addition to what we talk about here. All right, and on to question 10 from Nicholas. Can content for lessons, voiced over PDFs, flash presentations, PowerPoint, etc., be created in Rainmaker, or does it have to be made with another program then uploaded as media? Excellent question, Nicholas. The answer is that it does need to be made with another program, then uploaded as media. So with Rainmaker, you can create blog posts, and you can create pages, and you can create podcast episode pages, and you can obviously create LMS pages. And there are widgets in there to help you format and post the actual content, the multimedia content, but that multimedia content needs to be created within other programs. You know, so as you mentioned, you know, PowerPoint for a presentation. You might use Camtasia or ScreenFlow to do, you know, to do a screencast. If you have a video, you want to upload that to YouTube or to Vimeo, you know, and your podcast episode. While you upload that via the podcast page in Rainmaker, you would actually need to record it and edit it with another program outside of Rainmaker, and then you can upload it. You can use, if it's a download, you can use the download section of the conversion tools to actually dictate, you know, who can get it, what permissions are needed, all of that stuff. But the actual content creation and editing and all of that does need to be done outside of Rainmaker. Chris, any other insight for Nicholas on creating his actual content?
No, that covers it, I think. You can create image galleries, and you can do some basic cropping and rotation and things with images, but that's as much as you can do. You really need to be using specialist apps for all of that stuff. And it's kind of one of those things as well that even if we wanted to, we couldn't compete with these other, you know, Adobe and those kinds of companies if we even, you know, have the resource.
Yep. Okay, so I want to remind everybody that we have two sessions coming up. All right, so the next session next week, which continues kind of this minimum viable website section that we're starting out with, you know, what do you need just to get a website out there, is how to choose the best theme for your Rainmaker site. And the great Rafal Tomal will be with us, which is fantastic. So I'm excited to put that together with him. Chris, you'll be here too for that, right?
Not
sure. Is that just me and Rafal? All right, so we'll see. But Rafal is going to be there for sure. And that's obviously the person whose brain everybody wants to pick. And so we will get some great stuff from Rafal. And then we will also have a Q&A on Rainmaker design settings with Rafal the next week. So we get some of Rafal's time for two straight weeks. So he will give us some great insight next week. If we have any time at the end, we'll answer questions as we did for the last session. And then we will have a Q&A dedicated for just questions after that. So you can save up those questions and ask them there. And with that said, we do have about 10 minutes left. So Chris and I are happy to field any additional questions that you have about the basic Rainmaker settings over these last 10 minutes, if any come in.
So Nicholas has got a question about the media creation, asking about Camtasia. Camtasia is great. On the Mac, I prefer ScreenFlow, but Camtasia on Windows is excellent. And it's great because you can do screen recording, you can record audio, you can record the screen video, and you can actually edit video as well. A lot of people find the workflow easier than using something like Final Cut or Adobe Premiere. So for podcasts, we often use Adobe Audition, GarageBand, Audacity. What else?
I think you covered it for podcasts.
Yeah.
Those are the main ones.
Randy recommends Canva. Yeah, that's great. I actually use Sketch for doing really simple image cropping and image editing. As I said, there is a basic tool within the site. If you upload an image, you can go to edit image, you can do some cropping and things with that and resizing. But I like to do it with Sketch and Photoshop.
Yeah, I haven't used that one. I do. I use Canva for a lot of stuff. One of the main reasons why I like to use Canva, especially for, you know, some of my other projects, is the ability to share a login and basically create templates that everybody can access from the web, which makes it really easy. Because, you know, if I have a Photoshop template, I mean, you know, I'd have to kind of, and I guess you could just store that in Dropbox or kind of a general place. But I like the ease of Canva, especially for shared templates and just real simple stuff. That's worked well for me. So I can vouch for that one.
Yeah, I like Canva as well, but I stick with what I know.
So Randy says, doesn't know if this is within the scope of today, but quizzes. There wasn't really a question there, but we could, I suppose, riff on quizzes for a few minutes.
Yeah, quizzes are great, and you can do quizzes with Rainmaker. And it's not really a setting, and at the moment, it's pretty much version one. Dan's going to work quite hard on expanding the the quiz feature. Really, though, let's stick to settings-y stuff just for today, just because we've only got 5 minutes left.
Yep. Yeah, and I mean, I have to look. I don't know if we'll have a session just on quizzes, but we will certainly have a session that deals a lot with quizzes coming up in the future.
Yeah, when we talk about the LMS and courses, we'll definitely talk about quizzes because it's a good engagement thing. Question from Fred, are the results in the widgets all showing the past 30 days? Yes, it's the rolling 30 days. So it's not like the last month. You're not looking at January versus February. You're looking at the last 30 days in a rolling period.
Yeah, for Google Analytics it is, and then for some of these other ones like Rainmail and podcast downloads, you can choose your time period.
Yeah.
So you can choose it by the week, you can choose the month or the year, and it's the same thing for podcast downloads as it is there for email. And again, you have the ability to drill in a lot more on these. These are just widgets to show you the very basic overview, and then in the results section, you can really drill in on all of these.
So Heinrich is saying, not sure if we'll be able to set the site up. We do have a services team. You don't have to do all of this yourself. We do have people that can help, and they're not going to charge you for asking, right? They're not going to charge you for getting a quote for what you need. They can coach you. They can do a go-to meeting call with you to talk you through things. They can do things for you. So we know that everybody is at a different place with experience and amount of time they've got, So this isn't necessarily something that you have to battle on your own. And there's also third-party people that are eager to help as well, designers and website developers. So if you're struggling with anything, our support team is great and always happy and friendly to help you. And we've got services team who can do things for you or train you as well.
Yep, absolutely. If there are any final questions, we will get to them here.
A couple of questions about the HTTPS thing, and you will find that there's often an Easter egg in your website of a HTTP link that stops it working. And once you find it, it'll be fine. It's just hunting it down and finding it is the struggle. So what you need to do is use the site that Jared mentioned, go through it, and if you've got a membership area, obviously an external site can't look at that, so you just have to go through it with a fine-tooth comb. But it can be worth the effort.
Ooh, and Danielle did have a great comment. She said, you guys have the best customer service, worth every penny of this platform. I agree. Our customer support team, our documentation team are unbelievable and one of the best things that you get access to with the platform. There's no question about that. So I appreciate you recognizing them, Danielle, because you're spot on. And Chris, Danielle also asked if we're going to be creating an Instagram plugin anytime soon, which I would love to.
The problem is Instagram isn't really making it easy for people to develop for the platform. And I think it's intentional, they want people using their app, right? So a lot of the solutions out there are doing things that are a little bit naughty so that you can integrate with it, which means that Instagram can break it anytime they want to because they're not having to actually support these third-party developers. So it's something I'm keeping a really close eye on.
Mm. Henrik says, who do I approach within Rainmaker for a lead for outside help recommended by Rainmaker? I would go with support, and they have a list of people that they can recommend who are all proven and have done a great job, Heinrich. So that's definitely where I would go for that.
And the email address for support is always support@, and you can use support@copyblogger.com, and they'll route you to the right place, but it's always support@. And within your Rainmaker dashboard, you've also got a contact form as well.
So. Yep.
And in the help section of your own website, you should be able to get support from there as well.
Yep. Well, this has been fun. Chris, it's always great joining you for these afternoon Q&A sessions.
It's the best part of my week.
I agree. And we appreciate all of you being here. And again, we appreciate the questions that you submit ahead of time because, as you can see, it really gives us the opportunity to prepare some slides, prepare some screenshots, so that instead of us just talking and trying to walk you through, we can actually attach some useful visuals to it, and I don't have to try and do it live on a site because live demos just, something always happens with live demos. Just how it goes.
They're always exciting.
Yeah, they are exciting. So, again, the next session is next week. It'll be Wednesday. We will be sending out another couple of emails to remind you of that session, let you register. So we'll have something prepared for you for that session, and then the Q&A the week after. Any questions that you have after the session with Rafal, you'll have a chance to ask them about design. All righty. That is it for today and this edition of the latest Q&A for the Rainmaker Site Building Roadmap. We look forward to being back with you next week and talking about design with Rafal Tamal. Have a great day, everybody.